Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I'm Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, I want to wish you a happy 40th anniversary of Earth Day. As you are well aware, yes, today is the 40th anniversary. We mentioned that last week, and we know that ushered in a whole decade worth of environmental laws and new environmental protection agency, and not coincidentally, we're going to be talking about an environmental issue today. But I also want to remind you that next week, that is the end of April, the last week in April, will be our final Thursday Morning Roundtable session for the season, and our program will feature two representatives of Seneca Falls, the supervisor of the town of Seneca Falls, Peter Sames, and Phil Dressing, who was the chair of the Village Dissolution Committee. And as you may know, about a month ago, the village did vote to dissolve, and so they're in that consolidation process. And that is part of the reason that I had some copies of the booklet Patterns of Government in Onondaga County, which is a very useful resource put together by Focus Greater Syracuse, the League of Women Voters, and Carol Dwyer's Benchmarks program at the Maxwell School. So I have some extra copies. I have some others that I'll bring next week. Not that Seneca Falls is in Onondaga County, but you might begin to have some questions about our own government structures here in Onondaga County. So I refer you to that. So I do hope that you will be able to make it. And I want to remind you, as always, that our programs are taped by WCNY-FM. And if you miss any or you want to hear them again or refer anybody, they are on the WCNY.org website. And we thank WCNY very much. Speaking of WCNY, those of you who watched the program Food Inc. last night know that sometimes, in spite of the fact that we have some government protections, that they don't always work, or sometimes government is, you know, we're hearing in all of the budget discussions, doesn't have the resources to enforce some of the laws that are on the books. But in spite of that, again, we know that since Earth Day 40 years ago, that first Earth Day, we've come a long way. We still have a long way to go in many respects. The Onondaga Citizens League is working on its current study, What Does It Mean to Be Green?, which we will be issuing sometime this summer. And so you'll be hearing from us about that. And we hope that we will see you actually at the OCL annual meeting on June 2nd. But more about that later. Right now, it's my pleasure to introduce our two speakers today. Dareth Glantz is the Executive Program Director for the Citizens Campaign for the Environment, which is a regional advocacy group for environmental and public health issues. She has served on the Governor's New York Clean Water Collaborative, and she's served on the New York State Great Lakes Basin Advisory Council and Board of Directors for the Onondaga County Resource Recovery Agency, in addition to many other groups. Dr. Bruce Selleck is the H.O. Whitnall Professor of Geology at Colgate University, where he has taught since 1975. He is also the director of the Picker Institute for Interdisciplinary Science at Colgate. We will have time for each of them to give us some remarks, and then, as always, questions, and I ask you to raise your hand up high so I can see you when we get there. And thank you. Who is going to go first? Dr. Selleck, thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandra, and it's a pleasure to be here on Earth Day. I remember Earth Day 40 years ago, too, and it's interesting that we find ourselves here talking about energy and the intersection of energy development with other environmental concerns such as water quality on Earth Day. Is that better? Okay, thanks. A little bit of my background. I'm a geologist. I study rocks in New York and Alaska and Australia. I've gotten interested in this particular issue more in recent years because I also live in the town of Lebanon, New York, which is just west of Hamilton, and serve on the planning board and own property. And we've had a fair number of natural gas wells drilled just recently in that area. Those are not Marcellus shale wells. They're in a unit called the Herkimer Sandstone. And so we have some local issues related to natural gas development that have caught our attention. And so I've invested a fair bit of time in trying to learn more about natural gas development in New York. And that, of course, has led to a lot of discussions about the hydrofracturing in the gas shale units, the Marcellus, and potentially the Utica that may come in New York probably not until 2011, it looks like, right now. Yesterday, as I was driving home, I was listening to an NPR interview with Interior Secretary Salazar in anticipation of Earth Day, and he reminded the radio audience that we still depend in this country on fossil fuel for about 80% of our energy. And that number is not going to change very much in the next decade. We hope by proper investment and proper regulation, and I would say we need a carbon tax, that we can reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and increase so-called sustainable resources like wind power and solar and I would add nuclear. But in the meantime, we need fossil fuel, and gaining access to fossil fuel resources is dangerous, expensive, and environmentally threatening. I think I can say all those things based upon recent experiences in West Virginia, offshore platform in the Gulf of Mexico just yesterday that went up in flames with the loss of seven lives. So this is a business which has inherent risks in it. That is, whenever we go into the earth and do things in the earth to extract resources, there's risk, there's danger. And given where we find ourselves highly dependent upon fossil fuels, and wishing to at least somewhat reduce our dependence on imported fuels, that's where we find ourselves today. And my guess is it's going to, that circumstance in terms of dependence will continue over the next couple, three, four, five decades, hopefully declining to a point where we're beginning to find most of our energy from non-fossil fuel resources. So the title of what's up on the slide is Why Here, Why Now? Okay, all of this is great, but why is upstate New York seeing great interest expansion in natural gas? Well, the map shows us a lot. That map shows us that when it's winter in the northeastern U.S., people need to heat their houses. That's a satellite image showing a snow-covered upstate, most of the northeast. And when that happens, people burn natural gas to heat their homes. And the closer that natural gas can be found to the site at which it's burned, the more valuable that resource is. And the northern Appalachian Basin, really that extending from West Virginia into Pennsylvania and then into south central New York, is a considerable potential resource. And natural gas companies are interested in that resource because they can sell it more profitably because it's close to where it's burned. And, Sandra, could you move to the next slide? Thank you. And these are just some charts showing cost increases of natural gas. Right now, natural gas prices, like a whole lot of other energy commodities, are down in cost. A couple of years ago, the wellhead price of natural gas was as much as $13 per 1,000 cubic feet, and that spurs development globally, and it certainly has spurred development and interest here in the northern Appalachian Basin. And on the lower left is shown a slide which illustrates a new technology that's really been heavily developed over the past 15 years in the oil and gas industry, and that's the application of directional drilling to produce horizontal wells And in so-called gas shale units, that allows fracturing of the gas shale to allow gas to flow out at economic rates. And so it makes investment in gas shale wells economically viable for development companies. And if you could move to the next one, Sandra, thanks. In New York, we have one of a number of gas shale units which are found around eastern North America, and that is the Marcellus Shale, named for the town of Marcellus, New York, where it crops out on the surface. And this map shows where the Marcellus is found at the surface. It's an east-west trending belt of dark shale. When I was a student, an undergraduate, I learned that shale is not a source of gas, but it's rather a unit which serves as a cap rock for gas and oil-bearing horizons. Technology that's been developed over the last 25 years has really changed that view. Shale has become a new major source of gas. Shale gas has added to the U.S. reserves that are estimated by the U.S. Geological Survey, has added some 20% to those estimated gas reserves just in the last couple of years. That gas shale unit, the Marcellus, dips below the surface to the south. And so what you want to look at that map and visualize is that that red extends under all of the area that is to the south of the red line, to the south and really the west. And the Marcellus extends in that broad belt, but it's only economically feasible to extract the gas when the shale is deep in the subsurface. And that depth is a minimum, really, of about 2,000 feet. So if you move to the next slide, Sandra, this shows a rendering of where in New York the highest probability of Marcellus gas shale development is to be, and this is my personal development of this based upon data from existing data sources and published papers. It really lies in a sort of a U-shaped, upside-down U-shaped belt from Tioga. It includes most of Broome County, a tiny bit of Cortland County, some of southern Shenango County, much of Delaware County, and then on down into Pennsylvania, where there's active development going on today. And if you could move to the next one. Another unit that's mentioned and is of interest, where leasing has been, and some gas leases have been taken up recently, is the Utica Shale. It's a somewhat older unit, shown in blue on the map. It also extends into the subsurface, and on the next slide, we'll see that the Utica Shale development area is a little bit larger than that of the Marcellus. The Utica is an untested resource in New York. It has been drilled successfully in Quebec over the last 2 years, and I expect to see interest in the Utica growing as more and more is known about it. And as you can see there, there's a little bit broader area of potential development. On the next slide, we see a cartoon of this process that's called hydrofracturing in horizontal wells. Hydrofracturing has been done in New York for many years in vertical wells. It still is done. But horizontal, large-scale hydrofracturing involves drilling horizontal wells and then in stages using high-pressure water and with added components to increase the wettability, basically, of the water and to push sand into the open fractures. That involves many times more water than simple vertical hydrofracture wells. And this is, of course, one of the major issues that is of concern in this increased interest in gas shale development and is the subject of an exhaustive study by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, who have put out in draft form a supplemental generic environmental impact statement, 839 pages long. I've read it cover to cover, and it is thorough. It needs more work. There are opportunities there, I think, for great improvement in the way these wells will be permitted and regulated. And on the next slide, we get an idea of what one of these well sites looks like. This is in Pennsylvania. These are, I like to say, it's like building a Walmart supercenter in scale. It's a big, it's a large industrial scale operation that temporal framework is usually many months to a year of active development on the site. Lots of trucks, lots of water, lots of chemicals. It's a big deal. And the next slide, I think, is the last one. Clearly, the concern is what's put in the fracture fluid, and then it is, there's one more slide, Sandra. What's in the fracture fluid, a lot of additives, and then the amount of water that's required to be withdrawn from surface supplies, and then the amount of water, what we call flowback water, that needs to be disposed of. That's been an issue in Pennsylvania. In a way, New York is very lucky that Pennsylvania has been bleeding on the cutting edge, we could say it that way, of technology development for hydrofracturing. And I think we have a lot to learn and we have a ways to go. I'm comforted by the fact that we're not permitting shale wells yet in New York. I expect that we will at some point, simply because economic forces will demand ultimately that that gas gets extracted. The economic benefits to local communities, I think, in many cases are overblown or overestimated. However, for landowners, this can certainly be a very positive economic development. In our township, in the town of Lebanon, we are a poor rural community with a lot of dairy farmers who are on the edge of going out of business and losing their farms. And for those who have had natural gas developed on their land and get a royalty check every month, this has been a real, it's saved their economic enterprise. Townships that are impacted by drilling, like our town of Lebanon, on the other hand, have no way of significantly benefiting from natural gas development. And this is a real issue that I had hoped, I have written our local representatives and representatives at the state level to try to get some action on allowing local municipalities to develop better tax structures that will allow them to benefit and help pay some of the infrastructure costs that invariably develop when energy and natural gas development is done on this scale. So I'll stop there and let Dareth take over.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Selleck. I think you got a nice little overview of some of the key issues that are going on. So I want to be as brief as possible because I think there's a lot of stuff that we can talk about in discussion. So first of all, thank you so much for having me this morning. Happy Earth Day, 40th anniversary. This is very exciting. I couldn't think of a more important issue to talk about with you all today on Earth Day than the rush to use high-volume hydraulic fracturing to extract natural gas from shale. It may sound kind of wonky, but this is really important. It's going to determine what the face of our rural communities are going to look like into the future of what we're going to be talking about in the 80th anniversary of Earth Day. It's going to determine what quality of drinking water that we have, what kind of infrastructure is going to be crisscrossing our landscape, how are we going to be able to treat these volumes of liquid waste that's produced from this process. We have a whole host of questions, and when I talk about this issue, it reminds me of much like an onion. There's layers and layers and layers of issues that come up, and we need the time to make sure that we have the protective policies in place. So let me just kind of go over a few key things. First of all, my organization's been very engaged in this, and I want to make sure you know where I'm coming from. We aren't against natural gas. We're concerned with the extraction method, the waste byproducts, and making sure that our air, land, water, and people are protected from any impact from energy. All forms of energy generation have some impact. Some have larger footprints than others. So Congress recognized this, and about a month after the Supplemental Generic Environmental Impact Statement came out, Congress directed EPA to do a comprehensive study on the relationship between hydraulic fracturing and drinking water. That study is now underway, and we expect the results in September of 2012. This is something that we're very concerned about. In Syracuse, as you know, we get our water from from Skaneateles Atlas Lake. We have a filtration avoidance waiver that keeps our bills low, just like New York City does, from the Catskill Reservoir. We're also incredibly concerned about the impacts to groundwater resources, especially soil source aquifers, like in the Cortland area. So EPA is moving forward on this, and we think it's critical that we use the science and the most recent information to make smart policy decisions. The only geologist in the state legislature, his name is Assemblyman Engelbright, is carrying a piece of legislation that would enact a moratorium until 120 days following the issuance of that drinking water study from the EPA to ensure that we were able to use that information in the rules and regulations that we come up with in the process. In the meantime, there's no shortage of other work that our state officials and local officials can be working on. I want to just give you a recap of what Onondaga County has done so far. Onondaga County and our county legislature and the city of Syracuse have really been at the forefront of this. The city of Syracuse, led by Lee Macbeth, who is in charge of our drinking water, has really done some fantastic work. And Onondaga County has actually officially called for, the legislature has passed resolutions calling for the withdrawal of the supplemental generic environmental impact statement, has called on Congress to fill the holes. The hydrofracking industry is exempt from so many of those major environmental laws that we got adopted as part of the first Earth Day, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act, Superfund, which is that polluter pay bill. That's the reason why Onondaga Lake is getting some toxic sediments removed. So the liability issue of who owns the waste when it's on your property, when you're a landowner, is unanswered. And right now, it looks like there's a lot of liability that the landowners are going to be responsible for. One of the unique things about Marcellus Shale in particular is there's naturally occurring radioactive materials, or NORMS, which is an interesting acronym, in there. So when you drill, when there's radioactive material that's buried deep, 8,000 feet into the earth, you aren't exposed to that. There's not a route for exposure. But with that production brine that comes out, we've seen in just the vertical wells that have been drilled in the Marcellus Shale, the DEC did analysis as part in this review process and found they sampled 13 wells. 80% of those DEC tests found elevated levels of radium 226. And just so you know, to put this in context, because nobody thinks about picocuries per liter every day, that's how you measure radioactivity. And the standard in your drinking water, if you exceed it, then you're in violation, is 5 picocuries per liter. And so these wells, obviously you wouldn't be drinking this water, but just for context, these wells in Steuben, Schuyler, and Shenango counties that they tested came up with 1,779 picocuries per liter, all the way up to 15,000. The drinking water standard's 5. We're talking about 355 to over 3,000 times that level. So how do we treat radioactive water? The brine is 5 times saltier than seawater. For those of you that have hopefully taken a tour of the Metro sewage treatment plant, it's very cool, you know that you need to have bugs that treat that water, and you can't use a lot of salt. That is incredibly corrosive. We have an over $35 billion need over the next 20 years for our wastewater infrastructure alone, without even adding new, more challenging and caustic components to be treated. So we've got some really significant issues of how to deal with these large volumes of liquid waste. Every single well that's drilled needs, when you're using hydraulic slick water fracturing, you need to use between 2 to 8 million gallons of water mixed with chemicals and sand per well. And about 30% of that water comes back up as liquid waste. And then you also have that other liquid waste stream of production brine. One of the ideas on the table is to just have these open fracking waste lagoons, and you would store it there. We're very concerned about that. We think there's going to be any kind of contaminated water, it needs to be in sealed containers at a minimum, so you don't have surface leakage into surface water bodies, impacts to wildlife, a whole host of other problems when you have that stuff just sitting around. Liners break. They are not perfect. And that's drinking water. We talked about wastewater. I want to deal with air quality, too. A lot of folks may not realize this, but in order for this gas to become valuable, for folks to actually make money off of it, you need to have infrastructure to bring it to market. So you have to do that entire drilling process that Dr. Selleck walked through, and then you need to be able to site gathering lines so you can take that gas, bring it to the pipelines to ship it to market. You need to have compressor stations. There's a community in Texas called Dish, Texas, that has incredibly high air quality issues as a result of these compressor stations. You've got diesel that's operating, diesel-fueled engines. You have incredibly heavy trucks that are moving that are damaging roads. You're fragmenting habitat, and then you're leaving materials on people's property. So we believe that New York State needs to take the precautionary principle. This is kind of like raiding the savings account without having a clear plan of how you're going to use it and clean everything up. This gas isn't going anywhere, and this industry is relatively new. These processes, you know, in general, about two decades old. It changes and is constantly evolving. There's discussion about using different types of materials to hydraulically fracture, moving away from water, maybe considering propane or other gases. There's a new technology that's on the horizon but not ready for prime time yet that might be able to properly treat that toxic water that comes out. But we aren't there yet. So it makes a lot of sense in our minds to say, you know what, what's the hydraulic fracturing rush? Let's take a break. Let's make sure we have the sound science of how this is going to impact our drinking water. Let's make sure that we have a clear and transparent process for dealing with all the hydraulic waste. Let's have a comprehensive plan to make sure that as this infrastructure is being built, the pipelines, the compressor stations, that our local communities have a say in the future of what our communities are going to look like, and how industrial do we really want our landscape to be. We have agriculture is the largest industry in this state. We need to understand how that's going to impact our agriculture industry, tourism, and what the long-range economic realities are, and the unpaid and the costs to the local taxpayer from who's going to pay for the health monitoring? Who's going to do the baseline testing to make sure that your water isn't contaminated? Who's going to make sure that those roads that have really heavy trucks are being taken care of? There's communities in Dimock, Pennsylvania is cited most often. They can light their drinking water on fire right now because of methane that has gotten into their drinking water supplies. There's a class action lawsuit. Folks are suing Cabot Oil and Gas, which now was just forced by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection to take a one-year moratorium on any drilling operations because of all of these problems. They've had high levels of heavy metals in their water, high levels of methane. Don't drink methane, guys. Don't do it. So what we want is we need comprehensive regulations. A lot of this is outside the scope of the DEC as well. We haven't had real rulemaking on oil and gas extraction in New York State since 1985. We're following a generic environmental impact statement that was adopted in 1992. So we'd like to make sure that we have cumulative impacts that are assessed. There's a lot of pressure to move forward on this. Many of you probably saw that Commissioner Granis was in town, the DEC commissioner, on Tuesday. He said that drilling is likely to begin in the spring or summer of 2011. It's about a year before the EPA drinking water study is going to be completed. There's about 60 permits just waiting for DEC to act. There's a lot of interest that want to get moving as quickly as possible. And it's very important that we stand up and take what we have learned from the zillion toxic sites that we have around New York State, that we can move slowly, deliberatively, and be smart about our energy future to make sure it's sustainable for future generations, and we have comprehensive protections that we can extract energy that does not adversely impact our drinking water, our air quality, our land, and our overall public health and way of life. So I really look forward to a great conversation. I encourage you all. We released a report in January called What's a Hydrofracking Rush? That kind of walks you through the step-by-step process. And these resources are available at www.citizenscampaign.org/HFRAC. It's our Hydrofracking Resource and Action Center. So thank you.
So the two of you seem to be in agreement, I think. Maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Selleck, that you're saying, what's the rush, you know?
Yeah, first of all, I'd say that we here in New York are fortunate that Pennsylvania is running the experiment for us to the south. I am probably less optimistic that the EPA study is going to show us anything that's particularly new or interesting with regard to impact of hydrofracture technology on drinking water. Really the issue, and I do fundamentally agree with everything that Dareth said, but the fundamental issue is how we handle the water that comes back out of these wells and how we put the water down in. It's important to understand, and this is one key, perhaps, geological fact that I'll try to relate, is that if you drill a well, say, 3,000 feet down and then go out horizontally, and you put high-pressure water into it, it will make vertical fractures that cannot extend to the surface, cannot travel up into the aquifer. So the Hydrofracking Act itself, and this is also touted by the oil and gas companies, is in fact quite safe. It's what happens close to the surface that we need to, and at the surface that we worry about. In Dimock, Pennsylvania, Cabot was fined and has been not allowed to pursue any additional permits, not because of the fracking process, but because of spills at the surface. And so I think that we do need to move with great caution on this issue. I guess I would disagree that EPA is going to tell us anything that we don't already know.
So, and one of the things I was remiss to mention, but I think it's very important to realize what shape our regulatory enforcement agencies are in right now. As you all know, we're in a huge budget crisis, and the DEC has been bleeding staff. The governor proposed to slash additional staff. As you all know, we don't have a budget yet this year, but we're below Governor Pataki levels, which were pretty historic lows in DEC staff. So we're very concerned about that regulatory oversight that is so necessary, as demonstrated by behaviors by the oil and gas companies on the ground. We really hope to learn from the mistakes that have happened in Pennsylvania, but it's the issues of making sure that the casings are set correctly when you're drilling down, that materials are handled properly on the surface. Those are your greatest risks. And that's why one of the things with the EPA drinking water study that we think is very important to make sure that we have that latest science is we're going to be looking not only at just the drilling process, but the entire life cycle. So from the trucks coming on to the chemicals being stored to every step of the process when there's opportunities for contamination to get into surface waters, for aquifers to be impacted. And of all the states, there's about 7 communities that are served with filtration avoidance waivers, and there's 2 of them in New York, Syracuse, and New York City, which is just incredibly important for us to make sure that we don't do anything that damages our drinking water. So we think it's just a prudent way. It's definitely not the only piece. I think there's a lot of work that our state leaders need to do in the meantime to make sure that we have comprehensive protections, that we have the cumulative impact, that we have the Public Service Commission working on how the infrastructure and where the infrastructure will be placed, so that we aren't just flaring methane and contributing to climate change, because we weren't able to get that gas to market too, but we allowed drilling.
If the regulations and possibly legislation required the companies that are doing this to pay for the waste and the other problems that they produce, unlike in the last century, we're left with Onondaga Lake to clean up, and the industry that produced the waste is gone. If the companies had to pay for all the bad consequences of this action, would it sufficiently cut into their profit to slow them down?
I think... It is the case that currently oil and gas drilling operations are exempt from some Clean Water Act stipulations, and that's something that would be wise to change at the federal level, whether that will happen because of very strong lobbying on the part of the oil and gas industry is a whole other question. A kind of cradle to grave for gas and oil development approach would be great. Right now, if I have a gas well in a half a mile from my house that was drilled last summer, and if my water was contaminated by that process, which given what's going on right there is very unlikely, it's too far away and so on, the gas company, the developer, would be, as long as they were still operating that well, they would be civilly liable for any costs, if I could prove in court, of course, that they damaged my drinking water or whatever. Once the well is abandoned in New York, and this is the real issue in parts of Western New York State where old abandoned wells that were not properly plugged continue to bleed brine into surface aquifers, a much bigger problem with old wells than wells drilled since 1992. If gas companies had to go back and take care of those, they would be more careful. I think the profit to be made in extracting natural gas here in the Appalachian Basin right now is sufficient to push them forward in spite of any additional regulations on cradle to grave. That would be my view.
Yeah, we think it's really critical that at a minimum we need to have a bond that's posted that will protect anybody. You know that if your water is damaged on your property, that's worthless. So, and you know, if you're struggling to make ends meet and someone comes to your door and says, you know, I can pay you if you lease me off a piece of your land, it's going to be very challenging for you to say no. We completely understand that. But, you know, and we're looking at a lot of these leases right now, and it's really clear that a lot of folks did not have independent legal advice. There's a lot of provisions that they could have added or crossed out if they would have gotten some counsel, and that has not happened. So I think it's really important that landowners are very well educated so they do, so their property is protected. Because if they're bearing toxic drill cuttings on site, there's some significant issues with that. If you can decide if you want production on your property or if the compressor station is going to be on your property, there's a lot of really critical information. So we encourage folks to, if they are interested in leasing, that you definitely want to make sure that you contact a lawyer. And we want to see the industry being required to post a bond for any other potential problems that may occur. So that's not on the landowner or the public municipality, if that impacts the town, that they don't have to pay for that.
Given the power of money and the situation that you're talking about, government versus, in your opinion, what are the odds of the gas companies getting what they want above the will of the communities, the people? You're talking about a lot of pressure, lobbying. We're in a political climate where money talks a lot. How is your how are your feelings on what our odds are?
Well, I don't think I can give you straight odds, but what I can tell you is that with the commissioner saying that drilling would likely begin in 2011, that means that every single one of our legislators, there's an election this November. Every single state legislator is up for election. I've never seen communities come together around an issue like hydraulic fracturing. It's complicated, but once you kind of get your foot in the door, realize what the ramifications are and what the adverse impacts could be, people are compelled to organize that never thought that they would be an environmentalist or be concerned about these types of issues. I'm very encouraged by the strength that I see on the ground from folks getting involved in this. There's been a lot of really small victories. Another issue that folks that the industry has been looking to do is to just inject that liquid waste into these old gas wells. They wanted to do that in Pulteney, New York, near Keuka Lake, and then folks were just stood up and said no, and the industry decided to go someplace else. Not because the people said no, though, they said. But the people were incredibly strong. So I really do not want to underestimate the power of the public to, in these incredibly important public policy decisions. Your voice matters. Your legislators need to know how you feel and what you want them to do and that you're going to hold them accountable. That being said, their lobbyists are incredibly slick, very effective to be able to be exempt from these critical environmental laws, but we need to hold them accountable. But I don't want to underestimate the power of the people to tell your local officials that this matters and that you're going to be paying attention when you go to the ballot box in November.
Dr. Selig brought up a couple of other pressures, though, on state legislators, and that is the issue of the landowners themselves who don't see any alternative use. And so my question is, you know, rather than saying, okay, dairy farms are failing, so let's drill, could we say dairy farms are failing, so let's do something else? And I'm sure the town governments and all of that.
Right. Coming from a town where we've had considerable development of traditional natural gas in the last 10 years, I can say that a number of landowners who would have otherwise gone out of business and sold large family farm properties are staying in business. And expand that to that 5 or 6 county area that I showed on the map earlier, there are thousands, literally, of dairy farms that are on the edge. And we all know why. Price of milk is low. This is a difficult climate to farm in. We have some marginal lands, competition from out of state and even out of country for dairy products is considerable. I grew up on a dairy farm in St. Lawrence County, by the way, and got out, saw the writing on the wall back in the 1960s, and we sold the dairy. It was the saddest day of my dad's life. We sold the dairy in the late 1960s. And dairying is going to fail here over the next 20 years. I think the natural gas that's in the ground could be the savior of some or many of those large farms. We also have land coalitions which have grouped together that are quite active politically with local legislators. And their interests, of course, are I think, being more well looked after because they belong to coalitions that have been advised by talented legal counsel in most cases. So there are these forces. Economic forces are very strong. Don't you remember that Bill Clinton got elected by saying, you know, it's the economy, stupid? And here in upstate New York, we are in this really tough region when you get out into the rural countryside where folks simply cannot make a living. And so I think the push to drill and develop and sell natural gas so that royalties can flow to landowners will continue to be a strong undercurrent in this, and I think it will be sustained. I agree with Derek that the ability of local communities to respond and to group together and to organize is critical in all areas of environmental protection. Would that we had had this kind of scrutiny of a lot of activity back a half a century ago. But I do think that the economic forces are strong. The gas companies can go away for 5 years and go elsewhere, but they'll be back. The gas is in the ground. And in the interim, what I'd like to see, my preferred mode would be, let's do some science in a very carefully controlled experiment in a place where we know that we can isolate any potential damage. And let's really understand this process from cradle to grave. And I don't think the EPA is going to do that, to be quite honest. I don't think they have it's great that they're looking at drinking water in areas where there's been hydrofracturing, but they have not the capacity to do the kind of science, I don't think. And there's some great people at the EPA, great people at the DEC, but we really need to mount an effort to do really detailed, strong science at one of these sites and do it as a controlled experiment.
And then, you know, for we recognize that we really need to have other economic development alternatives that are environmentally sustainable, and that's what we're really talking about. Farmers need to harvest, food, feed, and fuel. So whether that's harvesting power from the wind, capturing solar power, using anaerobic digesters, there's lots of opportunities. We need to continue to have a strong policy on agriculture preservation in the state so that we can preserve farmland and we can ensure that we have local food production. We need to continue to support clean, renewable energy development, especially in our rural communities.
The Canadian shale, is this equated with the Marcellus shale? Because the horror stories that have come out of Canada as to a result of their effort to get the gas, the infrastructure that has been enormous and has destroyed an awful lot of the environment. Are these comparable, and are you doing anything to look at that compared to it rather than Pennsylvania?
Well, I think in Canada, the gas shale development that's going on in Quebec is in the Utica shale, and that's very small scale right now. But in the West, I think you're probably thinking of tar sand extraction, which is a surface mining technique which is environmentally incredibly damaging, because basically you're mining up a 30 or 40 foot layer of tar enriched sand, extracting it, and then liquefying the remaining waste and sand and dumping it in open ponds and allowing it to settle out. The scale of those two things are compared to, I mean, any sort of natural gas development is so much more environmentally safe than tar sands extraction that it's really hard to make the comparison. The places that we should really look carefully are places where, like Pennsylvania, or the Barnett Shale in Texas, the Fayetteville Shale in East Texas and into Louisiana. These are places where we've had horizontal drilling, hydrofracturing, gas shale extraction, and there are environmental issues there, mostly, again, related to the surface contamination that occurs at these sites.
Thank you for a fascinating conversation this morning. I'm really curious to hear you talk a little bit more about the broad overlapping districts, particularly with drinking water, whether it comes from the Great Lakes or Skaneateles Lake, or the reservoirs in the Catskills, because there are multiple counties, sometimes multiple states, multiple countries, and I'd just like to hear a little bit more about that.
Yes, those are really critical issues. One of the things that was passed a few years ago, and we're still working to implement it, is called the Great Lakes Compact. And all of the Great Lakes states got together and said that we are going to ban large-scale diversions, limit interbasin transfer to protect the overall quantity of the Great Lakes, which is, while it's an abundant, it is a finite resource. And so in New York State, we have water withdrawal regulations that's pretty spotty. In the Delaware River Basin, there's a very strong regulations. In the Susquehanna River Basin, there's strong regulations. In Long Island, which there's not going to be any hydrofracking in Long Island, there's a very good water withdrawal program. But the rest of us, it's kind of like the Wild West. So one of the key things that we need to make sure that the legislature does as soon as possible is to develop a water withdrawal legislation so that we know how much water is being taken, where it's being taken from, and that it's returned to its source watershed clean and without aquatic invasive species contamination, et cetera. So that is definitely on the top of the agenda. We're very concerned about how that's going to be enforced, recognizing the current limitations in the DEC right now. But we need to make sure that we are able to sustain our freshwater resources, which we're just blessed with such an abundant freshwater resources here.
I just like to make one brief comment about the New York State DEC, and I agree 100% that they are understaffed, underfunded, and they need more folks in place to do both the science and the regulation. But I would also say that I know a number of those folks personally, and there are some really, really top-notch folks in the New York State DEC who deserve a lot of respect and I think have taken a lot of heat for just following the procedures that they have set before them by their enabling legislation. And, you know, they have worked honestly and forthrightly through this process, which has been subject to enormous scrutiny. So just a little shout out on their behalf.
And to follow that up, I mean, the same goes, they're wonderful, wonderful folks. With these budget cuts, folks aren't able to get out into the field as much and travel, so we've got some significant issues there. And if you actually want to know how these really educated, wonderful folks that are professionals in the DEC are feel about the Supplemental Generic Environmental Impact Statement that their agency drafted, I encourage you to read their comments. You can read the comments of the DEC's union at our website, www.citizenscampaign.org/HFRAC.
The doctor, when you were describing Lebanon and you were describing the current gas wells that are in Lebanon from the Herkimer Shale, you mentioned that there didn't seem to be any problem there. What's the big difference between the drilling that's going on in your town and the proposed drilling?
Well, I would hasten to say that there have been some problems. We've had a couple of rig fires and some diesel fuel spills and some road damage. So, as I said at the outset, any energy development like this is going to involve some risk. But that said, the Herkimer Sandstone, which is the unit that's being developed by Norse Energy in Lebanon and to the south in northern Chenango County, is a sandstone unit that contains already natural fractures. And the technique that's being used is to drill vertically and then divert the well horizontally into that sandstone into fractures that already exist. So there's no need for hydraulic fracturing. In fact, this is a new approach that's just been developed by Norse in the past 2.5 years. And I expect, interestingly, to see other companies take it up in other areas because the Herkimer is widespread. It's not one of my slides up there. I have one on the Herkimer. And my expectation is that even if horizontal shale well hydrofracturing is not permitted in New York for some time, companies are still interested in the Herkimer and other units. And the reason it's less problematic is you don't need all the stuff that's involved with hydrofracking. Basically, you drill a well and then you divert it out a couple thousand feet. You clean up the well, you finish it, and the gas comes out, and it's great. And actually, we have a couple of very high-yielding wells in that field now, just developed in the last year.
Another point that came up was the fact that although there are a lot of efforts to reduce our energy consumption, our reliance on fossil fuels by developing other sources, to really reduce our use is going to require some economics. That is, energy is going to have to cost more. You mentioned the carbon tax. I know neither of you is an economist, but what do you think are the chances of that, and would that affect the economics of the hydrofracking?
I think natural gas is going to be a high-demand commodity in the years ahead, because it can replace crude oil in a lot of uses. It can also replace coal. Coal is the greatest producer of CO2 per unit of heat. And right now you can build a coal-fired plant and make electricity for 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Natural gas is 7.5, nuclear is 8.5. Wind, even with price supports, is 8.5 or 9 cents. Photovoltaics is up around 25 cents per kilowatt hour. The only way to make this work, to move away from coal first and then on to more sustainable sources, green sources, non-CO2 emitting sources, is to tax carbon and make the price of coal-generated electricity equivalent. I would shoot for nuclear just because it's a good, we know how to do that. And that's the way to start. Is there the political will in this country right now to do that? Absolutely not. We have a rock-bottom economy. We have a lot of people out of work. Most legislators are not worried about global warming or climate change or moving towards sustainability. They're worried about getting reelected when 12% of their constituencies are without a job.
I want to say that there is a link to the Citizens Campaign for the Environment on the schedule on the website for TMR. If Dr. Selleck would send me the slides, I can post those slides to the Thursday Morning Roundtable website. And I want to thank you both again. Again, Dareth Glantz from the Citizens Campaign for the Environment and Dr. Bruce Selleck from Colgate University.
Thank you.